Good morning, everyone. Thank you for jumping on the call this morning. My name is Campbell Kaufman, and I'll serve as the moderator for this morning's call. I'm a co-founder here at Cornerstone and serve as a principal and managing director for the firm. We are especially grateful to have Renee Bender on the call with us from the Senate Small Business Committee. She helped with the writing of the small business portion of the CARES Act. We also have Gabe Bukinga from Radius Bank, who's got more than 15 years working with the SBA as a 7(a) lender. And also joining the call, Camila Knowles, who's a principal and counsel here with Cornerstone, and she works out of our Atlanta and DC offices. Renee's going to provide an overview of the CARES Act small business provisions. Gabe's going to talk a little bit about the lending process, particularly with 7(a) lenders. Camila's going to address some of the a couple of the commonly asked questions, and then we're going to get into questions that have been posed by the group on the phone here in advance that have emailed those questions to us. At the risk of flooding that particular inbox, I will say that if a question comes up during the discussion that comes to mind while you're listening, feel free to send it to sba@cgagroup.com. If we have time this morning to get to it, we'll try, and if not, we can follow up. Later. Finally, let me say that the call is being recorded, and we will send out a link later in the week for those of you who would like to listen again in case there's things that you've missed or would like to cover. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Renee to kick things off.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Renee Bender, and I serve as senior professional staff for Chairman Marco Rubio on the Senate Small Business and Entrepreneurship Committee. I'm really pleased to be on the line with you all this morning. Thank you so much for the invitation to talk about the CARES Act and specifically the small business provisions in that bill. I'll start out by saying that Chairman Rubio worked with Ranking Member Cardin on our committee in a bipartisan manner with a number of other members on the small business portion of the law. Specifically with Senators Collins and Shaheen. So the four of them really worked together to ensure that small businesses would be receiving a number of different avenues of relief, but most prominently through what we have called the Payment Protection Program and the Payment Protection Program loan, which will be really what we're getting into today. So the goal here for the chairman and ranking member and Collins and Shaheen is to provide relief to small businesses and entrepreneurs and in that structure, keep the employer and employee relationship intact during this time of public health closures. So to keep those relationships intact through covering 8 weeks of payroll costs for employers and providing additional funds for fixed costs like mortgage payments, rent, leases, and utilities. So first of all, who is eligible for these loans? So any business, we did a straight employee count calculation for this. So any business with 500 employees or fewer, or if you have an industry for which your SBA employee size standard is higher, an example I provide here is manufacturing. A lot of times manufacturing industries have their SBA small business size standard might be 1,000 to 1,200 employees. So those industries would be able to use their SBA size standard would be eligible for the loan. So we are not using any revenue-based size standard here, employee only. We have also included nonprofits that are organized as 501c3s as eligible entities, veterans organizations organized as 501c19s, and tribal businesses. We also include independent contractors, self-employed, and 1099 workers as eligible for this relief. How is the loan calculated? So the loan is calculated by taking the average monthly payroll cost for the previous year for your business, or if you are a newer business that has not been in operation for a year, you would take your average for January and February of 2020. That average monthly payroll would be multiplied by 2.5 in order to cover 8 weeks of payroll and provide some additional cushion for those fixed costs that I mentioned before. included in payroll support are things like paid family, medical leave, and maintenance of group health insurance, insurance premiums, et cetera. The maximum loan amount is $10 million. Next, during what time frame could you receive a PPP loan? So you can choose, if you go to your lender and you say, I would like to cover payroll for this 8-week period of time, at the time that you get the loan, you can choose the time frame that you would like to cover. So the covered period that we have in the legislation is February 15th through June 30th. Dating back to February 15th, when some parts of the country were experiencing these public health closures, through January 30th, when we know, June 30th as the endpoint. So a borrower could apply for a PPP loan through June 30th. And again, the borrower may elect the time frame within that covered period that they would like to cover payroll for. The loan forgiveness part of this, so if you use the loan for the costs that have the covered costs, including your 8 weeks of payroll and the fixed costs that are allowed for forgiveness, the entirety of your loan would be forgiven. And that forgiveness would happen after the 8 week period after you receive the loan. Now, we do not restrict the loan from being used for other working capital costs, like an example would be inventory. However, that portion of the loan that's not used for covered costs would not be forgiven. So following up on that, what are the terms here? So we waived fees for borrowers and lenders for these loans. We have waived the credit elsewhere test, which is a test that has normally been applied to the 7A program through SBA. We have also waived collateral requirements and personal guarantee requirements. So the goal here is for lenders to be able to move these loans out quickly to borrowers who need this relief immediately. So we're really trying to streamline the process to allow for these loans to move quickly. Again, any portion of the loan that is not used for forgiveness purposes would just turn into remain a loan. So you wouldn't be forgiven for that portion. And we've included a max term of 10 years on any unforgivable portion with a maximum interest rate of 4%. So when the borrower comes in to get this loan, you would pre-certify with your lender with your use of proceeds. So you would say, I'm paying 8 weeks of payroll and I plan to use the additional amount for maybe it's insurance premiums or maybe it's a mortgage payment or a lease, and you would pre-certify that to the borrower. At the back end, after the 8 week period, provide documentation to the lender in order to receive forgiveness. So there is the forgiveness piece, you have to have the documentation to receive forgiveness, and these pieces on the forgiveness side, a lot of this will be fleshed out in guidance that SBA and Treasury are working on as we speak to roll out this week. We expect for initial guidance from SBA and Treasury to be released today with the top line parameters and with additional guidance to roll out throughout the week on some of the nitty gritty details. So you can certainly expect for, I think, the front end, the application process to be outlined by SBA and Treasury in the short term, and then they will continue to provide guidance on other pieces of the legislation. Now, in order to really make sure that small businesses across the country have access to this program, what we've done in the legislation is take a two-pronged approach. And the first piece of this is by using the existing infrastructure of the SBA 7A lenders, and Gabe will be able to speak a lot more to this process. But this is a program that has been in place for decades. It's a government guaranteed program, meaning that it's a public-private partnership between SBA and private lending institutions. So these lending institutions they're doing government guaranteed lending. They know how this works. The baseline 7A program and some of the parameters are in place already are meant to be used as the infrastructure to start getting the first wave of loans out as quickly as possible. So really the 7A program and those lenders are intended to kind of do a first wave of loans out the door. And we have also included the ability for the Treasury to approve additional bank and non-bank lenders to get to provide these loans so that we can build capacity across the country. So in order to really get to a number of businesses being able to receive assistance as soon as possible, what we've done in the bill is make sure that any 7A lender who is currently approved by SBA would be, for the purposes of these specific loans, considered to have delegated authority, which means that they don't have to go through SBA to approve these loans. So whether they are delegated right now or not, for the purposes of these loans, they would be considered delegated. Additionally, any new lender that comes in either through the SBA or is approved by Treasury for the purposes of these loans would be considered to have that sort of fast track delegated authority to make the loans. The SBA and Treasury, in working on their guidance, are working to make sure that the terms are identical, if whether you are going through an SBA approved lender or a Treasury approved lender, so to really have symmetry. So the borrower, it doesn't matter where you go, which lending institution you go to, you should be able to get the exact same product no matter where you're going. So we're using the existing SBA 7A infrastructure and then building out to add more lenders. Keep in mind that current SBA lenders can be your community bank that's in your community. Is also the fact that some of the largest banks in the country, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Citi, Bank of America, all have SBA lending divisions as part of their banking infrastructure. So you're going to be getting. You can look for a lender within your community, look to one of these national banks, and then again, Treasury will be building out a more robust capacity building group of lenders to provide these loans. I will stop there and be happy to answer questions, Camp, in whichever format you would like.
Thanks, Renee. Super helpful, and I suspect that's going to probably generate some additional questions. But let's switch for a minute and have Gabe talk a little bit about it from the lender side of the equation before we jump into questions. Gabe, you're up.
Sure. Good morning, everyone. This is Gabe Buking. I'm the president of our government guaranteed lending group at Radius Bank. First, thank you, Camp, and the entire CGA team for being on the forefront of this bill and just continuously advocating for your clients as well as the small business and nonprofit community as a whole. And Renee, thank you so much for that oversight. The work that you and your colleagues have been doing is amazing. We speak to dozens and dozens of small businesses every single day, and this bill has really provided some hope to companies and their employees in a challenging time. So I cannot say enough good things about what you and your colleagues have done with this bill. In terms of, Camp, did you want me to speak on behalf of the traditional SBA 7A product and then jump onto the Paycheck Protection Program, or what's the best format?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you can talk a little bit about how it works generally or has worked generally with the 7A program, and then talk about some of the calls that y'all have had with SBA in terms of what the guidance is going to look like and that Renee referenced coming out in the next few days.
Sure. So as Renee alluded to, this specific program, the Paycheck Protection Program, is radically different than traditional SBA lending. The intent is clear. The guidance is to do a couple checks, check to make sure the business was operating since February 15th, make sure the company has 500 or less employees, check payroll, and get the funds out the door. So the guidance we have given has been crystal clear. This program is not meant to require a traditional underwrite. Rather, it's a check the box and get the proceeds out. And that's what Radius Bank and all the banks are preparing to do, which again is radically different than traditional SBA lending, which on average takes 45 to 60 days. There's a pretty in-depth collection process with historical financials and a formal SBA application. And that again is a 45 to 60 day process. We're not required to collect all those same documents with this Paycheck Protection Program. Again, it's meant to be extremely streamlined. We're requiring very little documentation up front. We do expect to have the formal guidance from SBA, like Renee alluded to, sometime either today or this week. We have a pretty good idea of what it's going to, what we're going to be required to have. It's going to be payroll verification, most likely a year-end 2019 financial statement just to help calculate the payroll and benefits expense, as well as some sort of payroll verification on the number of employees. We anticipate there'll be a couple additional items needed, but again, very streamlined, low doc process, much different than your traditional SBA product, which requires, you know, last 3 years of business tax returns, personal tax returns, PFS, formal application, and so forth. I wouldn't draw much comparison between this new program and traditional SBA lending, because they really are radically different in terms of documentation needed, as well as the how streamlined this process is going to be to get the funds out quickly through the Paycheck Protection Program.
Sweet. Thanks, Gabe. I'm gonna run through a couple of some of the common questions that we've been getting as a firm from our clients and friends and so forth with Camila, and then get into some of the meat with Renee and Gabe, and with some other questions that have been submitted previously. So Camila, just in terms of the basics, when can folks apply for the Paycheck Protection Program?
So because you're going to be applying through an SBA lender as soon as they are ready to take applications. And so I would probably defer a little bit to Gabe on that exact timing, but it sounds like if they're getting guidance sometime this week that they should be ready to go as soon as that guidance is finalized.
Yeah, I can speak a little bit to that. So we're setting up, and every bank's going to handle this differently, but we're setting up an online application just to streamline this process. So we have our online application built internally. However, we're going to have to tweak some things upon final guidance from SBA. So what I'm advising clients is it won't be live, I would say, within 24 hours of formal confirmation from SBA. So as Renee alluded to, we have initial guidance today that's going to help significantly. We'll probably have about 80 to 90% of our application prepared, knowing that we may have to tweak the remaining 10 to 20% when we get the final guidance. So I think every lender is going to be a little bit different, but I would say anywhere between a day or two for the well-prepared lenders to perhaps a week or two for some of the lenders that may not be as prepared. Again, like Renee mentioned, I think the traditional SBA lenders are going to be probably the best prepared, so specifically the preferred SBA lenders, just because they've had a little bit more lead time to prepare for this. And then I do think most lenders will participate in some fashion. I just think that the latter groups can be a little bit behind the existing preferred lenders.
And Camila, as we know, that there was previous funding in the first COVID bill around economic injury disaster loans that some folks have already been able to apply for directly through the SBA, through their online portal. If I'm a small business and I apply for the EIDL program and get money, can I also apply for the Paycheck Protection Program?
Yes, you can. And what they'll probably have you do is refinance that economic injury disaster loan, the EIDL, into the Paycheck Protection Program. There are a couple of points I would make is that you can't use the funds from those two different loans for the same purposes, so you'll need to be careful about that. And then when you look at the forgivable loan, the EIDL, some may have taken advantage of a $10,000 grant in the EIDL, and that $10,000 would just be subtracted from whatever amount is going to be forgiven under the Paycheck Protection Program. But the bottom line is that, yes, you can take advantage of both of those.
Got it. And there's been a lot of talk about this cap around employees who make more than $100,000. Do we have to exclude employees? Do we have to exclude employees who make that money, or is it just a cap and you can include up to that $100,000?
So the way I read it, and Renee's here, so I'll let her correct me if I'm wrong, is that you just prorate those employee costs. So if you're a company that has somebody that makes $120,000 a year, typically that would be $10,000 a month, but you're only allowed to include payroll costs of up to $100,000 a year. So you would just divide that $100,000 by 12 to get the monthly prorated cost for that employee, which I think is around $8,300. But Renee can correct me if they intended something differently.
No, that's exactly right. Salaries up to $100,000 can be included in both the loan calculation and the forgivable amount.
Excellent. We've also gotten a lot of questions. We do a lot of work in the agriculture space and farming space. Are agriculture-related businesses excluded from these SBA programs? Can they apply in any sort of fashion? And if not, can they find relief in other parts of the bill?
So I believe that for the Paycheck Protection Program, any kind of business, including farm businesses, are eligible. I think with traditional SBA programs, the agriculture community has been excluded. Typically, that community uses the USDA Farm Service Agency for its small business lending. But for purposes of this Paycheck Protection Program, agricultural businesses should be able to take advantage, provided they meet all the other criteria.
And then one more on the sort of commonly asked questions before I turn some back towards Renee. How do you figure out how to calculate the forgivable loan amount? And this may be something for Gabe or Renee as well as Camila, but is there some sort of example a simple example that can be shared about how to calculate that?
So what's gonna be forgiven, my understanding, is gonna be on what you're actually spending on the forgivable cost. So that's going to be your payroll, your mortgage, which is the interest, not the principal, or your rent, and then your utility costs, which the legislation indicates that includes gas, water, electricity, transportation, internet, and telephone. And so for that 8-week period, your actual costs, and I think they're waiting on guidance about what documentation would be needed to prove whatever you were spending, is how you're going to get the forgiveness for those costs spent on those items. You can borrow 2.5 times of your payroll costs, but you can spend proceeds of the loan on more than just payroll, and then those kind of four things are eligible for forgiveness: the mortgage interest, not principal, rent, payroll, and utilities.
Got it. Okay, let's switch back, Renee, to some of the things that you talked about. Some of this stuff was not covered yet, and so maybe we can do this through Q&A. You did reference 501c3s and not-for-profits. We've gotten tons of questions about whether or not, and I know you can't speak or commit your boss or the rest of the committee to this, but I know a number of folks are curious if there's been discussions or if this could be on the table as to contemplate including C6s and C7s in future legislation.
Sure, thank you for the question. I think that it's first important to understand the state of the 7A program prior to the Paycheck Protection Program provisions. And one thing that's important to note is that prior to this bill, nonprofits have not been eligible for SBA 7A loans. SBA has considered them to be passive businesses, and therefore they cannot receive loans. So this is a new new provision for SBA. So I think a lot of this will come down to a lot of the way nonprofits are treated in this initial bite at the apple that we took. I think we fully expect for there to be, you know, everyone seeing the news. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. We fully expect for there to be conversations about additional legislation to provide relief, depending on how things go over the next few weeks. So first of all, including nonprofits is a departure from general 7A practices. So SBA and Treasury will be working through what that looks like for the nonprofit side. We originally, you know, in looking at this, really tried to focus this provision to be a little narrower for the purposes of our main edict here is to provide relief for small businesses, for for-profit small businesses. And certainly in normal circumstances, the amount of money that's going in here, $350 billion, is a lot of money for the extent of what we're trying to do here, covering payroll costs for small businesses across the country, in addition to some of the fixed costs that they really need to have some help with. You can see how those numbers start to crunch. And so I would say that, you know, if there is further conversation on payroll protection, specifically in further legislation moving down the road, I'm sure we will be having all those conversations. There are a number of folks that have reached out in different industries about participation. So I'm sure we will be having that conversation. I think we'll be really eager to see how SBA and Treasury handle guidance and how the first sort of tranche of loans going to nonprofits goes.
Got it. Okay. There's also been a lot of talk about small businesses that are backed by venture capital or private equity. I know there's been a lot of media attention paid to this. Can you talk a little bit about their eligibility, whether it's the intent of Congress for them to be included, and if not, any thoughts about how that might change in the future?
Sure. You all probably know that the venture-backed startups and small businesses get caught up in affiliation roles. SBA considers the investment made by whether it's a small business investment company, which is the investment side of SBA, or a private PE or VC firm, to be a control for that business and create an affiliation issue. So in the legislation, you may notice that we have included a couple of waivers for certain industries from affiliation standards. And one of them are small businesses that have received investment from a small business investment company. And so clearly we intended there for that control not to be considered an affiliation that would preclude them from receiving financing here. And so we are in conversations with SBA and Treasury to further clarify that startups and small businesses who receive minority equity investment be eligible for the PPP loans. So that is very much, you know, conversations day by day as recently as yesterday. So it will depend on the guidance that SBA puts out, but we have indicated where the congressional intent is. So we're hopeful that SBA and Treasury will take that into account when guidance comes out.
Perfect. Let's switch gears and talk a little bit about tribal governments. You know, tribal governments and tribal-owned businesses, it looks like, are eligible for the first time under the CARES Act. Presumably, SBA is going to provide specific guidance to the 7A lenders on how they're treated. Any thoughts on whether that's going to be different than a regular small business versus a tribal business?
So what we did there, in order, you know, this was moving quickly and wanting to make sure that tribal governments were included, is we included the citation in the code for the four HUD zones. So that includes both tribal governments and Alaska Native corporations, and are defined under the HUD zone citation in the law. And so we fully expect for, you know, we wanted to use the definitions that were already in place at SBA that they, in order to provide a framework for them to more quickly be able to work through guidance on the loan side. I think it's very much the case that they will have to be more nuanced in the guidance for the for tribal businesses and Alaska Native corporations. Certainly we have the 8A program at SDA as well, in which there's heavy participation by Alaska Native corporations. So there's certainly a familiarity with doing programming around ANCs and tribal governments in at SBA. So I think we're hoping that they, you know, take what is already there and take a nuanced approach to how this would work for the loan program. But again, because we sort of try to be all encapsulating by just including, you know, we need to cover these businesses, it'll really remain to be seen how that guidance works.
Got it. And I was going to ask about Alaska Native, and you covered that as well, so I appreciate that. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about how, you know, we've now got three different pieces of legislation that have passed to try to help the country deal with all of this, one of which, of course, is the Families First legislation. We've had some questions around whether if businesses, small businesses, try to take advantage of the PPP program, is that going to limit the availability based on benefits that they might also either be eligible for or take advantage of in the Families First legislation?
Sure, great question. We really tried to be nuanced about what has been included in previous legislation, including when Camilla covered the EIDL infusion on the disaster program side. That was included in the first stimulus package. And so we do have that refinance option in this bill. Now, in order to sort of address the Families First legislation and what small businesses may have taken advantage of, what we have done in the bill is just say you can and should take advantage of the paid leave provisions that were in Families First. If you did take advantage of that, great. We will just subtract that amount from your forgivable amount. So basically you can take the relief provided, and you wouldn't be able to count that towards your PPP loan.
Got it. Okay. I'm going to give you a break for a second and switch over to Gabe and ask a couple of questions for him. Gabe, you talked about the streamlined nature of the program, documentation and so forth that is likely to be required. Are there certain things that would be disqualifying, things like federal tax liens or credit scores and those sorts of issues?
We have not seen any indication that would be applicable. And even for the traditional SBA products, if you have an outstanding federal tax lien, as long as you're on a payment plan, you're still eligible, and there's not really a minimum credit score as it pertains to eligibility. It's more of a kind of prudent lending measure, and you look at the history of the applicant's credit rather than just if you're under 660, you're disqualified. So those two parameters don't exist for traditional SBA lending, so we don't find them to be applicable for this Paycheck Protection Program either.
Okay, got it. And Camilla talked a bit about the kinds of expenses that can be included. We did get a couple of questions that drilled down into that, things like when you look at utility payments, phone payments and so forth, you know, does that include everything? Let's say that you're paying for an employee's, you know, cell phone, or you're paying for their mileage for transportation and those sorts of things. Can that all be rolled up into the program?
That's not entirely clear. I mean, I think the utilities as it pertains to the small business, right? So the water, the electric, all those would be eligible uses of proceeds. As it pertains to reimbursements for employees, I can't see how mileage reimbursement would count towards the payroll plus benefit calculation. However, I'm not entirely sure on that. I assume that it probably doesn't as it pertains to your calculation on payroll plus benefits. Obviously, any use of proceeds for utilities of the small business would apply and, you know, be permissible. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, bottom line is we'll have to see a little bit of guidance from SBA.
Yeah.
There's also been a whole bunch of questions about things like independent contractors, 1099s, part-time employees, all those sorts of things. Can you or Renee, either one, talk about how small businesses should think through their 1099s and contractors when they're calculating their payroll?
I could take a quick pass and then hand it off to the expert on it. We see this operating very similar to calculating the payroll benefit expense for your traditional companies that have that full-time employee and the payroll and benefit expense, with the caveat that independent contractors, they're obviously going to be issuing a lot of 1099s in terms rather than the traditional payroll and benefit expense. So I think there's going to be a little bit more documentation required to just proving out those expenses through 1099s and so forth. And again, I think this is going to be spelled out pretty clearly from the SBA guidance memo. But I'd turn that over to Renee too to see if she has anything else to add.
Great points by Gabe. I would just add that we obviously have tried to thread the needle to make sure as many people are covered as possible here. So we do have provide for independent contractors and 1099 workers separately in the legislation. So I think it's very likely, and again, this will depend on SBA interpretation to some extent, on whether they count those folks will be separately applying, or where they would count them towards the employee count. I think based on what we intended for here was if you have independent contractors or 1099 workers that are separate, have kept separate tax filings and certifications, that they would be able to apply themselves rather than be included in the employee count. But again, that will really depend on, it'll all depend on how SBA interprets that.
Got it. Okay. The next area that I wanted to cover, and it's already been discussed a little bit, but I know there's still a lot of questions about this, and that relates to the affiliation rules, franchises, and so forth. If you look at things like restaurants that have a franchise model versus restaurants that might be, maybe their franchises or their locations are mostly owned by, you know, a corporate entity. You've got car dealerships that are franchise models. And you've also got, the NAICS codes for various, industries. Can either Gabe or Renee talk through, this may be more for Renee now that I think about it, but talk through a little bit more how that's going to play out, or do we need to wait for guidance from Treasury and SBA before folks who are in those industries and have that kind of a corporate setup can understand better what they can apply for or if they're eligible?
Sure, I'm happy to start, and if Gabe wants to jump in, I would always appreciate his thoughts as well. To the extent possible, what we're doing here, obviously this is a very fast process for outside of our normal legislative, how long it would take to draft a bill like this. So part of the reasoning too for using the infrastructure of the 7A program is that you have built in a lot of these regs already that we did not have time to flesh out in a great detail. For example, you'll notice that we don't identify what are ineligible businesses or verification of the borrower, all things that Gabe can speak to, but those already exist within the SBA 7A program. So to the extent that we weren't explicit about certain things, the intent there is for the underlying 7A program rules to stand. And so we have waivers of affiliation for the industries that were immediately and tremendously impacted by the public health closures in the hospitality and restaurant space. Now, certainly at this point, you'd be hard pressed to find an industry that isn't impacted. So I think, you know, that will be taken into account, I think, if we do something in the future as well. But at the time, we were looking at those that we're hearing from many senators from all over the country on those specific industries. We also have the franchises that are we waive affiliation rules for. Now that is specific to the franchises that are on SBA's internal franchise directory already. SBA does franchise loans, and they have an internal franchise directory that they have maintained since they changed franchise rules at the beginning of 2017. So those are in place as well. So that's where we were explicit. If you are in the hotel industry or restaurant industry, and if you are in a franchise that is on the SBA franchise directory, or if you've received investment from an SBAC, you are exempt from affiliation rules. Now, I think that there will be a lot of questions about how SBA will, in guidance, keep another important piece here is that right at the end of Section 1102, which outlines the Payroll Protection Program, we have rescinded a rule at SBA. Now, this rule has been ongoing since September 2018. What the rule would reinsert affiliation rules from 2016 and then some. There were a number of expansions, including some very wide sweeping language in that rule that would, I think we heard from many, many lenders, would really quell lending and really make a lot of lenders very nervous to do some of the loans that they were doing very easily at the time. So we rescinded that rule in order to provide more flexibility for businesses who are going to have to deal with affiliation issues. But I think at the in rescinding that rule, I think we are showing the congressional intent that there be that SBA take a more nuanced approach to how they're going to determine affiliation for businesses. I think there are going to be a number of businesses and structures that SBA hasn't dealt with traditionally, hasn't seen in the 7A program, that they're going to have to think through. So part of this is guidance, and I would think it's possible in the guidance realm that they may have to release guidance, get feedback from a lot of people about things they didn't think about. Certainly the way we do when we do a bill, we release text of a bill, and we get feedback from all kinds of people on what works, what doesn't work, and why, and the things that we haven't included. And I think that will be the same in this situation as well. So unfortunately, it's a little bit of a see what SBA, I know I've said this ad nauseum now, what the guidance is. I can only share what our congressional intent was. And then I think, you know, absent a report that goes along with the bill, we're going to try to share some of our congressional, more so than we already have, some of the congressional intent that we have with SBA to help them as they move through some of these more complex issues, but certainly affiliation will be a big one. And Gabe, I would welcome any of your thoughts as well.
Sure, yeah, that's a great oversight. So any franchise that's on SBA's approved franchise registry, from my interpretation is, in going back to Renee's comment on congressional intent, there's usually a couple items we have to collect for those franchisees. It's an executed franchise agreement, and then some specific documents pertaining to the actual site. So they're basically waiving that, realizing we're not going to have time to get executed franchise agreements and specific franchisee information. So that requirement has been waived for any franchise on the existing SBA-approved franchise registry, as well as waiving that affiliation if you have the NAICS code starting with 72, right, so the hospitality type businesses. However, the way the bill reads, unless SBA provides pretty flexible guidance, if you're not on the approved franchise registry, there does seem to be a affiliation issue for franchises not on the approved registry. I will share that franchises that are not on there the past week have been scrambling to be put on there, specifically car dealerships. We're working with one right now, a large dealership that was not on the registry. they have sent all their documentation in very short order, trying to be added. So I think one or two things are going to happen. SBA is not going to kind of broaden what's eligible, and franchisors are going to have to really scramble to get on SBA's approved registry in short order, or there's going to be guidance issued that really kind of broadens the scope of franchisors who are eligible. Because it is a streamlined process right now, as long as you're on that registry. And I think what this bill does is it removes the follow-up documentation for those approved franchisors. However, it does not allow currently non-approved franchises to be eligible, from our interpretation.
Excellent. Well, obviously, obviously more to come on affiliation guidelines and franchises. And without without putting too much, Renee, on your plate, obviously the group that's on this call, and certainly we will be helping our clients to engage with their congressional delegations once the SBA guidance comes out, as you pointed out. You know, guidance comes out, we look at it, we review it, and then we work with SBA and with our delegation, and certainly with the House and Senate Small Business Committees, to try to refine that as we go through this process over the next few weeks. I was right by suggesting that folks could email questions while we're doing the call, and I flipped through a couple of them I think that are probably relevant and that and can probably be answered. So I'm going to throw a couple more out there before we close up, before we have closing remarks and shut down for the hour. One question that that came through: are companies eligible to receive both state and local support as well as federal support? And/or are there any? Would there be any caps on money that that a company might receive if they're getting it from different sources, federal and state?
I'll take first stab at that. This is Renee. No. We know we have had that question from a number of folks whose states have set up, for example, bridge loan programs. And Florida has had a disaster bridge loan program for quite some time. So Chairman Rubio is very familiar with that setup at the state level. And they have recently set up a bridge loan program for COVID affected businesses specifically. So the answer is no, we do not prohibit any, there's no prohibition against getting state funds and also applying for PPP. There's no cap, other than the caps that are in our legislation for specific to the PPP, we don't have any restrictions against any other sources that you may get funding from.
Got it. Another question that came through during the hour that was really a, in part a reaction to some of the stuff that y'all were talking about. Questions about capital costs, not being eligible for the loan forgiveness. Obviously, capital costs in many cases are essential to business operations. Any thoughts on whether that might be considered in future legislation?
I think there's probably a number of things that would be considered if there was another go at this, or if there was a, you know, I'm just speaking off the cuff, but if there, you know, they either looked at expanding what we've done with the payroll protection program or doing something additional and separate. Certainly, you know, what we were doing here was trying to cover those immediate costs that we knew payroll and the things that we knew businesses would need some extra money to try and cover, because what we're looking at is if we pay payroll costs for 8 weeks that is forgivable, but we don't cover any additional fixed costs, then is there an inherent there's an inherent issue of if you're able to pay your people but you can't cover any of your additional costs, if you come back into operation, can you ever recover if you can't cover some of those costs? So those are some of the things we were thinking about in that calculation. So I certainly think that there will be a number of things that may come up, you know, as businesses say, what about these different costs that may be under consideration in the future?
And this is Camila. I would just add, I mean, there are some things that I think they did go ahead and extend coverage to. If you look at the definition of mortgage obligations, You know, you can't pay principal, but you can pay interest, and that's on any real or personal property. That's going to be in the forgivable portion. And then the second thing I would just comment on is that it does allow you to use proceeds of the loan on interest on other debt obligations that the business has that were incurred prior to January 30th. Now, those other debt obligations are not forgivable, but you do get some funds to pay them. And then, you know, it can be used as that longer term SBA loan that Renee mentioned at the start of the call.
Great point. Thank you, Camila.
Great. I'm just flipping through to see if there's any other obvious questions that I think make sense for y'all to answer. I'm sure we're going to have to do a bunch of follow-up with folks that are on the call. I did get an interesting, two interesting questions from a CPA that's on the phone. One is, how would you consider salaries for partners in a partnership? You know, where they, you know, typically would take a draw and then get something later on. Is that something that the lender community is going to have to figure out? Is that something that the SBA is going to provide guidance on? Any thoughts on that?
We think it's going to be eligible, and it could be confirmed through, you know, accounting paperwork and the P&L we get. That seems to be required. But I would be curious Renee's opinion. I think it's going to be eligible up to $100,000. However, it's a little bit speculation until we have SBA's guidance memo, but perhaps Renee can comment on the congressional intent.
Yeah, we intended for any salary up to $100,000 to be covered. So to Dave's point, I think SBA will have to provide some guidance as to how, you know, how you document those salaries to report the pre-certification of the forgivable amounts. And one thing I would say here, the SBA and Treasury have been, one of my questions to them was, are we gonna make this certification for the borrower to the lender a streamlined one to make this as easy as possible? And the answer is yes, to the extent possible, they will have a streamlined pre-certification a document for the lender. So I think it'll depend on how they identify, you know, how they identify some of these nuanced salaries, but the intent is for any business that qualifies be able to cover salaries up to $100,000.
Got it. Well, look, we're nearing the end of the hour, and I know that there's a million things that folks have to do in this crisis that we're dealing with. I want to thank Camila and Gabe and Renee for participating in the call today. And I want to thank everybody who jumped on the call to listen. As I mentioned, we will do our best to follow up with other questions. Please send those to sba@cgagroup.com. And please be patient as we run through all of those questions and emails. We'll do our best to try to get answers for folks, and over time do one-off phone calls as well. Would just offer if any of the three of you have any sort of closing remarks before we shut down the line.
Glad to be here and participate and be able to help going forward. I do think the congressional intent behind the bill is very flexible, lenient, and, you know, our direction is to get funds out quickly. And I from talking with colleagues at other institutions, everyone reads that the same. So I do think this is going to be a quick process once we have SBA's guidance memo. And again, just would like to thank Renee and the SBC. They did a great job on this bill with really taking a lot of the concern and liability away from the bank to encourage us to get the funds out quickly. So that's our intent, and I know a lot of my peers' intent as well.
This is Camila. I just want to thank Renee and Chairman Rubio and everybody on the Hill who worked on this. I think this is a really fantastic program built for small businesses. And I would just say this relationship with your SBA lender is going to be really critical for the small businesses who are looking to take advantage of this, because so much has been delegated to them. They're going to be making a lot of decisions within SBA guidelines. So just real excited about the prospect of this to help a lot of people.
This is Renee. I'll just say I really appreciate being able to be on the call today. Certainly, there are a lot of things that will need to be worked out in the coming days with SBA guidance and Treasury guidance, and just know that we are in this for the long haul to do everything that we can to help small businesses during this time. So welcome your feedback, welcome further conversation, questions. We know there are a lot of them, and we're trying to be as responsive as possible to get answers as quickly as possible, and hope that this is something that can really be impactful and helpful for small businesses who are on the line right now, that we are, we came into this process after the House bill didn't have, as much for small businesses. We would like to really try to build off of some of the great paid leave stuff that was in that bill and say, you know, we really need to focus on small businesses here. And so that was the chairman's intent, and we really hope are working through this implementation process to work with the agencies to get the clear guidance out to lenders so they have the confidence to do this, to do these loans quickly. And Gabe, I'm very heartened that is the message that you've received, and to our small businesses to provide as much information as we can and get as many of our resource partners, the SBDCs, the Women's Business Centers, others, getting information out there to help small businesses access these loans as quickly as possible. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks again, everybody. Please try to stay safe. Don't forget to wash your hands and practice social distancing. It sounds kind of silly, but we got to do it if we're going to get through this. The new normal can be challenging, but we are all in this together. We will get through it, and certainly Cornerstone, all of our colleagues will do whatever we can to help folks to get through this. So thanks very much, and y'all have a great day.